In a moment, we will talk about mysticism, clairvoyance. Our special guest is Dr. PhD Diane Pomerantz, and we're going to be talking about Catherine Hayward. Who is Catherine Hayward, you might ask? You'll find out in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Diane Pomerantz with us, dedicated her life to animal and environmental welfare and to spiritual research and exploration. Now, sharing the story of a very renowned spiritual teacher and mentor, Catherine Hayward has been a labor of love for her. Additionally, she has authored a number of books, is best known for her books about animal companionship, specifically the human-animal bond in grief recovery. Diane, we've got a lot to talk with you about tonight. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Yes, we do.
This work on animal companionship with humans, this is so critical to people. I think people who don't own an animal or never have, they'll never understand this bond, will they?
I don't think so. I think it's really necessary to experience that relationship, and there's no other relationship quite like it. Animals are intuitive, highly intuitive, and they operate on an entirely different level than we do. They are the truth. They're genuine. They're not unpretentious. They don't have an agenda, and they're non-judgmental, unconditionally loving, loyal, etc. So when you are close with an animal, there's just an unspoken bond that unites you and knows that you and the animal, whatever it might be, dog, horse, cat, etc., are one. We're all interconnected. We're all interdependent.
You got your PhD. What did you get it in?
In mass media communications from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Oh, how about that? I went to the University of Detroit.
Oh, did you really?
Yes, I did. And I got my degree.
Detroit.
I got my degree in communications.
Oh, how funny. Yeah. Well, I live in Southfield, Michigan.
I used to work in Southfield, Michigan.
See?
WJBK, right up the street there, 9 Mile in Greenfield.
Oh, my gosh. That's right near where I live. That's very funny.
When did do you still live out that way?
No. Now I'm in Dallas, Texas. Long story.
I've been to Dallas a lot.
Many stories and long stories.
Do you still have family in Detroit?
Yes, I do, actually, and I have some in New York and some in California.
The Northland.
I've been all of the above.
I'm told the Northland Mall, which was where you lived,
yes,
is gone.
That was the big deal. What? I had not heard that.
I'm told they shut it down. I better check on that, but I'm pretty sure.
Oh, my goodness.
Sign of the times.
Weekends, that's it. That's where I hung out.
My gosh, that's funny.
That is.
What places did you go to?
Oh, my God.
People listening to the show saying, come on, get into this clairvoyant stuff.
Well, this is all part of it.
That's right.
That experience. I learned a lot. Actually, most of the time I was in school in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was there for 8 years.
Great
so I
school.
I was only in Southfield for a couple of years. Oh, the best. It was go.
Were you there when Bo Schembechler was the football coach?
The glory days.
Yep.
Yes.
I had produced the part of the Rose Bowl with CBS. Back in 74, 75, whenever Michigan played Washington in the Rose Bowl and lost, by the way, that was sometime. But what a great university, of Michigan.
And it was. And the law library and grad school and, just the Diag. It was wonderful.
Well, that's
I didn't trade it for anything.
So you get a degree in communications. How did you end up writing books, especially about a woman named Catherine Hayward?
Well, I was in the entertainment industry for about 35 years. So my degree in mass media, I went to 30 Rock, and I was hired. My first job ever was as a production secretary for NBC Sports with Brian Gumbel. And that was in New York, of course. And then I was promoted, and I moved up to Captain Kangaroo.
That's funny.
You remember the kid's show?
Oh, I sure do. Did you know Bobby Costas at all?
No.
Okay, yeah. He's a friend of mine from St. Louis. But I never knew Captain Kangaroo.
Well, I did. So there.
Bob Keeshan. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Green Jeans, Lumpy Branum, yep.
Favorite cartoon when I was a kid that he played was Tom Terrific.
Oh, I love Tom
you
Terrific.
Remember the kid with the little thing on his head?
Yeah. Of course I do.
Yeah, and he was able to do some mystical things, and he could turn himself into anything. But you always would see his head and that little funny upside down.
Yeah, we need to revitalize
funnel.
All that.
Yeah, those were great days. Those were great TV shows too.
They were.
So, anyways, you start writing. Tell me about your relationship with Catherine, who was.
Well,
a British mystic.
Short, I moved from New York to L.A. To further my career in the entertainment industry, and a dear college friend of mine and I ran into one another, and after learning that we lived about 2.5 miles away from one another, she said, there's a woman that you have to meet. She's remarkable. She is amazing, and she has helped change my life around. And I knew my friend Michelle had been through an awful lot, and she was doing so much better. I mean, she really had her act together. And so I said, yeah. And Michelle had told me this woman was 79 years old at the time, had retired at the age of 60 to the United States from Britain, and that she was psychic and that she had these Sunday mornings. But she was far, excuse me, far beyond psychic. She had studied spirituality. She had studied spiritualism. I can go on and on and on with that, which I will probably a little bit later. At any rate, I attended a Sunday morning meeting, and at that meeting I sat directly across from Catherine. It was an open house in her home in West Hollywood. She lived in a little Jane Marple-like bungalow. It was all British chintz and flowers in the vases and antique furniture, etc. And she was a very frail, slight lady. And if you know the actress Judi Dench, she could have been Judi Dench's sister.
Ah,
same voice,
same look.
Yeah, they separated at birth. Yeah, they were very similar. And Catherine began to speak, and there were about 35 people that attended the group in one large circle. And she began to say things like, there is no death. You couldn't die if you wanted to. The real you is not the mind or the physical body, but the power that motivates the mind and the body. Well, she had me hooked because there was like a mental checklist, and I had done a lot of spiritual studying. I was introduced to Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda at the age of 15, and that had deeply impacted me, and I studied the Hindu religion, and so had Catherine. Catherine was very well studied in terms of world religions, etc. At any rate, she taught that thoughts are things. Thoughts are very powerful, and as you think, you create. And again, I had this, you know, mental checklist of everything she was saying I already knew. And she taught that life on Earth is a school, and we're here to evolve spiritually. We're all students at varying grade levels from kindergarten to postgraduate school. And, of course, the people that believe in an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and violence, et cetera, were in preschool. And the Mahatma Gandhis, Mother Teresa's of the world, of course, Jesus, Mohammed, Buddha, were in the postgraduate school of in terms of spiritual evolution. So I immediately was hooked, and I said, I want to study with this woman. And I became her student, and I saw her 3 or 4 times a week. With my yellow pad in hand, just like I had in college courses and grad school courses. And I listened to this woman, and she possessed this extraordinary magnetism. She was a very powerful personality in spite of her small frame.
And she was up there in age at that time, wasn't she?
She was 79.
Yeah.
And I was 28. So here's this formidable woman, charming, very theatrical. She came out, the meeting began at 11 o'clock, and the room was full by 11, and she came out at about 1 minute to 11 and sat down in her chair as if it were a throne. But she wasn't pretentious or affected or anything like that. She was who she was, and caftans were comfortable, and she had no room in her life to be uncomfortable just for appearance's sake. And but she was well attired, bejeweled, and she was charming. She joked and just a fascinating woman. And anyway, I began to study with her. And she had told me when I met her, "You're every bit as psychic as I am, my dear." And I said, "What?" And of course, I didn't use my gifts in that way. However, 6 months after I met Catherine, my ex-husband gave me about 9 birthday gifts. And I mean, they were all, you know, camouflaged by wrapping paper and boxes and so forth. But I went to each one and I knew what was in it before I opened it. And he almost fell to the floor. He goes, "How did you do that?"
You almost fell to the floor too, I bet.
Well, it was the most natural, inevitable thing on the face of the earth. It was just, I knew what was in those, you know, packages. And shortly after that, I woke up writing a story that took place in the 1930s. And I remember it was about a children's author named Esther Bedelay. And I wrote in a way that I don't normally write. I had just written a doctoral dissertation. And, you know, this was not my writing style at all. And at any rate, not long after I started writing this and looked at it with wonderment, saying, "This is really good. Where did this come from?" Any which way, after that, I woke up one morning knowing that I was going to write Catherine's life story. So after a Sunday morning meeting at her home, she was going away for the weekend, and I approached her, and I said, "Catherine, think about this on your holiday. I believe I'm going to be writing your life story." And she said, "Well, I'll think about it. I'll let you know." And she went away up north in California and came back. And, of course, her student, her loyal, dedicated, eager student was waiting for her, and we had a session together. As soon as she met me, she hugged me, and she said, "You are no longer my student. You're my protege, my coworker."
Wow. What a compliment.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It was enormous to me.
Well, was she, Diane, more of a psychic or a medium? What would you call her?
She was all of the above. She was a healer. She had been trained in a spiritualist church, although she was not a member of the spiritualist church, but a spiritualist healer had saved her father's life in Wales. And he told Catherine, her mother and father, and Catherine's husband, that they were all mediums, and that they needed to be in communication with their spirit guides. And I forgot to mention one thing, because we went right into meeting Catherine. Excuse me.
Yeah. Don't forget, when you cough, I'll teach you a little radio trick. Move.
Oh, good. Please do.
Move your mouth away from the phone.
You got it.
Don't cough
Thank
into
you.
The phone. You know why? Because you'll blow our ears out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
But thank you. I will incorporate that.
Just a little technique. See, I have a little button. If I ever have to cough, I hit a button, and then you don't hear me. Did you see that? How I just disappeared?
Oh, clever. But, well, I'm not that prepared.
But you don't
have
that.
My own button.
So you have to kind of like move your head a little bit and then cough. But go ahead.
Anyway, when Catherine was 7, she had contracted out of the blue double pneumonia and pleurisy.
Oh, boy.
And she, at that time, remember, turn of the century Wales, and she was in Gwaelod y Garth, Wales, not far away from Cardiff. But keep in mind, medicine at that point in time, and she was very, very desperately ill and eventually was pronounced dead by her doctor.
Oh, geez.
And Catherine recalls going to another plane of existence and communing with these glorious beings, angelic beings, she called them. And they were very kind, and she loved being there. It was so peaceful and calming. And she recalled that they kept telling her, "No, dear, you must go back into the body. This is not your time. You have great work to do on Earth." And she did go back into the body and was in excruciating physical pain. And when she finally awakened, she spoke in a full, mature adult voice and knew past, present, and future. She was also completely changed in personality.
What would you say was her greatest gift to us?
That the teaching that there is no death. That throughout World Wars I and II, and think Downton Abbey and that whole era of the war that was to end all wars, she comforted and offered solace to the people that she shared this information with, because she could communicate with the so-called dead. She talked to dead people and could give family members the comfort and joy of knowing things about this person who had died that no one else could possibly know. And so that was a proof to them that, well, there is life after death. You continue to exist. The real you is immortal. And she did this, as I said, throughout World Wars I and II, worked with a lot of New Thought centers and lectured and did the platform in England, throughout the UK, and Europe, et cetera, at that time. But that was her greatest gift. She was also a Red Cross nurse at the hospitals in London during the Blitzes. And again, through her work of proving that you survived death, that there is life after death, comforted thousands and thousands upon people. Remember, we didn't have media back then.
That's right.
So, that's right. You know, it wasn't millions of people that we can reach today. It was thousands, and it was word of mouth, and word of mouth spread rapidly. And she was in great demand as a lecturer, speaker, demonstrator of the proof of survival.
Though we are not in any rush to leave this existence, right?
Right.
I mean, I want this to last as long as we can. And then when we go,
make the best of it.
That's right. Well,
and as she said, life on Earth is a school, so you're here to learn. And you want to be the best. You want to be the A-plus student if you possibly can. And get it right. And ultimately, when you do get it right and achieve mastery over the emotions, over the physical body, et cetera, there is no further need for you to return to planet Earth.
Well, as
other spheres of life.
Diane, as her protege, did you learn to do many of the things that she learned?
I did, but I did not use them in the same way. Remember, this is a totally different era. And so much of what Catherine did was pioneering work. The witchcraft laws, in fact, were in operation in England at the turn of the century. Her parents did not encourage her to make public predicaments or even, you know, with friends and family, because they discouraged that. They were fearful of the ramifications. So it's a whole different generation. But you know what's very funny? I became a grief counselor about 15 years ago, 1999, 2000. And it only occurred to me, I had an epiphany at the end of finishing editing Catherine's book, which was a couple of months ago. And I said, you know what? I'm continuing her work as a grief counselor. And tying in with the pets too, I help people deal with all kinds of grief. But my particular niche, my specialty, is helping people cope with the loss of a beloved animal companion.
Well, you wrote a book called When Your Pet Dies, which was a great book for kids. You're right.
Thank you so much. With an accompanying CD so that it could go into the schools, in the schools and libraries all over the country. And it helps children cope with and recover from the first, often the very first significant loss they experience.
That's very traumatic for a child.
It is.
When one
exactly.
of their animals or pets die.
Well, they have such a unique bond and unique relationship.
Yep.
These animals are non-judgmental. They're not, clean your room, you know, go, you know, do this, do that. And they don't criticize. They accept you for precisely who you are. They're authentic.
Stay with us. We're going to come back with Dr. Diane Pomerantz, author of a book called Catherine, A Woman of Vision. And we'll also talk about one of her other books, of course, the children's book, When Your Pet Dies, because I would say the great majority of you listening to this program right now have had a pet or still do. And what happens when your pet dies? That's pretty darn traumatic. We'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Diane Pomerantz with us. Diane, let's take a few minutes as well. We're going to take calls with you next hour, but I really want you to talk about your book, of course, When Your Pet Dies, the children's book. That's also apropos for adults, isn't it?
Oh, it's appropriate for any kind of grief, as a matter of fact, and that's one of the reasons I wrote that book for children specifically, because we're a culture that does not deal well with grief. You know, other cultures celebrate grief, celebrate the life of the lost one, and mourn at the same time. and it's acceptable, and people gather together to appreciate the lost person. Here, we tend to dislike to talk about it. It's distasteful. It's not pleasant. And so here we are, and especially in the case of an animal, I mean, people are ashamed and embarrassed to talk about the loss of a cat or a dog or a horse or a rabbit or whatever it might be. So I wrote this book for children, and I had it illustrated by a little girl. I held a contest at one of the local schools, gave them some text to match up with their drawings, their illustrations, because I wanted kids to speak to the hearts of other kids. And it offers the tools for grief recovery and gives them the tools to deal with the divorce or separation of their parents, financial loss, loss of property, loss of profession, graduation, which may or may not appear to be a grief issue, but it actually is, because it's bittersweet. You're leaving one part of your life behind you when you're entering into a new phase of life. So there's marriage, there's emptiness, there are all sorts of grief issues that arise, and we're not trained or socialized to deal with those. And so I'd hope my books would help people. And in addition to that, I wrote a book for adults, although it is illustrated as well, called Finding Peace After the Loss of a Loved Animal Companion. And first and foremost is the identification that you're grieving, the realization that this loss is palpable, tangible, real.
What is it about the loss of an animal that is so traumatic to a family?
It's a loved one. It's a member of the family. And beyond that, it's non-judgmental. It's loyal. It's unconditionally loving. When do we experience unconditional love, and from whom? These animals offer that. They don't ask for anything in return. They ask to be loved. And so when we provide them with that, they're happy. And they, in turn, give us so much more than we give them. They're guide dogs. I got a letter from a gentleman who listens to Coast to Coast this morning, and I was very touched by it. And he went under the name of Dog Boy Dave, and he talked about owner-trained service dogs, and for veterans, you know, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, etc. And these dogs, I have several therapy-assisted animal therapy dogs that go into care flight, hospitals, assisted living centers, work with special needs adults and children.
They know right what to do right away, don't they?
They cut to the chase.
Yeah.
They have no barriers. They go to the person in the greatest need. And I have witnessed miracles, truly autistic people that have not spoken in years, who pet the dogs and start crying and talking. And people who witness that are just flabbergasted that an animal can do that. But we have so little understanding of how much these animals provide us. And, you know, they've served as transportation in war dogs and war horses, you know, in combat, etc. But we don't really pay attention to the many profound gifts they give us, and that includes physical health, our physical and mental well-being.
Diane, with pets, when they die, a lot of people will say that they've come back. They see little paw prints on the bed. They're convinced that they come back. What do you think?
I think that's probably legitimate, and I think that applies to humans that they've lost as well. I have one dear, dear friend who lost her husband a year ago, January, and she talks to her husband every single night. And just some extraordinary stories. It could go on and on in terms of her own experiences with her husband, Tom. And one of her dogs visits Tom and plays with him at night and specifically changed behaviors when Tom died. And my friend Kathy is in touch with Tom all the time, receiving his advice, his suggestions, his messages, etc. So, I believe that to be true.
How did you get involved with the animal portion of your work?
I've always adored animals. And when my dog, Caesar, died in 1998, 3 days after Christmas, and he was a rescue dog who had been through so much trauma and so much abuse, I grieved as I had never grieved for my father who died of lung cancer, for a dear friend who was 42 who died of AIDS. And I witnessed that whole end stage of AIDS healing and treatment and so on and so forth, the rallies, the ups and downs, all of that. And I had lost dear friends to pancreatic cancer, but you name it. I had never grieved anyone or anything as much as deeply as I had my dog Caesar, whom we call the Schmeez.
How old was he?
About 13 and a half, we think. They're all. I have 9 rescue dogs as we speak, and I at one
Good
point
for you.
Had 22. And I work with the SPCA of Texas and created their pet grief counseling program, which is free to the public, and we counsel people who have lost a beloved pet. So,
what do you say though to people who can't take care of a lot of pets, and they do? They're like overflowing.
No, that's not smart, and it's not good for them or their pets.
That's
They're
right.
overworked, and no, that's not a wise decision.
It's like hoarding.
I had to, yeah, right. I think that's something to be avoided. You don't want to do that. You don't want to collect animals. You're not being fair to them or to yourself. And some of the conditions in which we find these pets, as I said, I work with the SPCA of Texas. So, you know, these animals that you find in a hoarder's home are in such horrible condition. And that's not rescuing them. Rescuing them is providing a healthy atmosphere, a happy, loving home, and taking good care of them and making sure they see the vet. They have issues, health issues, just as we do. And that's another thing. One of my books is called Animal Elders, Caring for Our Aging Animal Companions, because we seldom stop to think, you know, Fido's getting old. His muzzle's gray and grizzled, and he's limping, or he's not walking as well as he or she did, and so on. And, you know, we really need to think in terms of how much these animals teach us about our own health and aging process, and that as they slow down, well, guess what? As we age, we slow down too. And so it's a matter of looking at them and, you know, heart conditions, heart disease, diabetes, etc. They're impacted by many of the same diseases and limitations that we experience as we age.
So your books are available where?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, just about everywhere.
What are you working on next?
This is my 9th book.
You don't stop.
The next book is going, pardon?
You don't stop.
No, I'm pretty prolific these days.
That's good.
I have another one coming out soon called The Power of Being Alone.
What is that all about?
Well, that's all about me being at the pyramids.
Really?
In Egypt, yes. And they had an incredible light and sound display with beautiful music against the sunset. And here I was in this majestic, extraordinarily beautiful environment. And people were on their iPhones, their iPads. They were talking to each other. What do you want to do afterwards? You want to go out to eat? And, I mean, no one, they had their cameras out. No one was there. Talk about mindfulness. No one was present. And I couldn't tolerate that. And I said, no, I need to appreciate and respect where I am alone. So I got up from my seat in the amphitheater and went way to the back of the amphitheater where I could soak up, absorb that energy, that experience, the beauty, you know, the awesomeness. And I don't use that term loosely. I mean, it was really an awesome experience. Historically, spiritually, etc. So that was my motivator for The Power of Being Alone.
Let's go back to Catherine for a moment and talk about her life. She saw the sinking of the Titanic before it sank, didn't she?
Well, I was going to say she didn't physically see it. No, she predicted that it was
in her head.
Yeah, and her uncle had booked passage, and she said, "Oh no, uncle, you mustn't. Please don't. It's going to sink." And again, remember, her family was hushing her, you know, please don't talk. But he ended up listening to her, and of course, we all know what happened to the Titanic. But she did many things like that. Someone would knock at the house, the door. She was invalided. She was in rural Wales. And she would say, "Mom, those are the Williamses. They're bad people. They do bad things to children." And the Williamses were convicted of child molestation months later.
How did she know? How did she know this?
She just did. And, you know, we all have this intuition.
Yes, we do. And some people use it better than others.
Well, some people can access it more easily or are prone to use it. And I know mine serves me really well in assessing people's character and determining, you know, their agendas or whatever. And that's how my intuition works. And also I'm open to inspiration and love receiving that inspiration. And I'll just start writing. And I have no intention of writing what I'm writing, but it's meant to be meant to be written. So there I go. And then I review it and I think, ah, this is very interesting. But of course, you know, everybody uses it differently. And in dangerous circumstances, they sense danger. They sense when someone is truly loving and caring. And I think all of us got a dose of that with Pope Francis, that this is a man that's not about show or display or and of course, this is varied, subject to various opinions. But mine is that he radiates love and compassion and humility, and we sense that we know the truth from the untruths. Many of us do, I should say.
Are you at a point now, Diane, where you have a pretty good grasp on what the other side is and why it exists?
Well, I think it's much greater than just the other side. I think that there are many spheres of life interpenetrating one another. And Catherine had taught that all life is one life, and that there are all life is energy operating at different rates of vibration, so that we may have amongst us many different beings, creative forces, powers that are in our midst. But just because, just as in electricity, we didn't know it existed 200 years ago. I mean, people, what? Or light waves, sound waves. I mean, none of this existed just because we couldn't physically see them. But that does not mean they do not exist. So I think it's very comforting to think that there are many different rates of vibration and beings, let's call them beings for want of a better word, that exist simultaneously with us and in many different spheres of life. And my understanding is that we're here on planet Earth to experience the density of physical matter, that we're here to learn on kind of the preschool level of life, of how to manage our bodies and our minds and achieve mastery over our emotions, etc. So that's my belief.
Reincarnation?
Believe it. Absolutely believe it.
Do you keep coming back until you reach this level of perfection, then you don't come back anymore?
You know, again, that analogy of life as a school. We don't pass second, third, fourth grade until we've, you know, achieved a certain grade and understanding. And it's the same thing with our spiritual growth. We keep coming back until we get it right, and then we pass, and then we move on to the next spheres of
life. And that could be many lives. Until you come back.
Many, 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 many lives. Yes, it could.
Do you think someone who is a, let's say, a serial killer will come back until they reach perfection as well? Or
yes,
do they end it somewhere?
No, I believe they do come back. But there's karma, the law of cause and effect. So whatever they have done to others,
they may come back as a victim.
Precisely.
Interesting take. Of everything you've studied about clairvoyance, the other side, life after death, what fascinates you the most?
Our human potential. I think we are so much greater than we give ourselves credit for, and that if we tap into our true human potential, we can go so much farther in co-creating with other cultures. Peoples all over the world, now that we have the media, we have access to the inner workings of so many different cultures on this planet. And I think that we can expand our abilities, expand our potentialities, expand our gifts and share them and help co-create a planet of peace. And I think that was Catherine's primary purpose in living, to promote peace on Earth. And I'll never forget her groups that work for peace because, as I mentioned before, she taught that thoughts are things. Thoughts are very powerful. As you think, you create. as you think it manifests. And where two or three are gathered in my name, right, that there is great power in those thoughts of peace. And so she always had these groups that worked for peace, and we sang Let There Be Peace on Earth way back then. In the late 70s, early 80s, we were working for peace on Earth, and that was ultimately her mission, having survived two world wars and seeing the desecration, the decimation of her civilization as she had known it.
Well, let me tell you something. It's not really working because we're not having peace on Earth. That's the problem.
Ah, Maya, illusion. We are going through growing pains. And this is all a part of that, the fabric, the weaving of our civilization. What happens during all these, the floods and the natural disasters and the shootings? Communities are drawn closer together, and it brings out the best in many, many people. So ultimately, we're learning to care and support, care for and support one another. And I think that's a significant part of our growth, to be not me-oriented, but community and culture and civilization-oriented. I mean, we have a whole lot of work to do to help Mother Earth, of whom we are a part. It's a living organism, a living, breathing organism, and we've decimated that. And all the species that are becoming extinct. Oh, don't get me started. No, so this is all part of the growing process, the growth process.
What is, for you, one of the wonders of clairvoyance and the ability to use it? Because you believe people can be trained, don't you?
Well, not all people. Again, it depends on what grade level they're at spiritually, what they accept as the truth. And I believe clairvoyance can be a very profound gift through which to help other people, because you can put them in touch with people, situations, thoughts, books, etc., that can enable them to live better, happier, more peaceful and serene lives, and more worthwhile lives. Encouraging someone to develop their potential, traveling throughout the world, as I've been blessed to do, you meet these indigenous cultures who are so in attunement with the planet, just as Native Americans are, et cetera, the Aborigines are. There's so many different, the Maasai.
Oh, they're all over the place. We're going to come back and take some phone calls as we talk about your pets and the other side.